Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books and Buddhist Studies with Alex Carroll. On today's podcast, we talk with Richard Gombrich about his new book, Buddhism in Pali, published by Mudpie Slices. He puts the richness of the Pali language on display by introducing the reader to the origins of Pali, its linguistic character, and the style of Pali literature. Far more than just an introductory book, he argues not only that the Pali canon records the words of the Buddha, but that the Buddha himself is responsible for the Pali language. Richard convincingly shows that by learning about Pali, we learn about the spirit of Buddhism itself.
Richard, thank you very much for coming on the podcast.
My pleasure.
Richard, you've had an illustrious career as a scholar of Buddhism and Pali, and you've contributed much to the field over the course of your life. In the prologue of your new book, you talk about how you first came in contact with Buddhism and the Pali language. Could you share some of your story with us here?
I went to a school, a very famous school in London called St. Paul's School, which was founded in the early 16th century, for children of all nations to be taught indifferently. That doesn't mean it was for them to be taught badly. It meant that there should be no prejudice between different ethnic backgrounds or anything like that. And that's why my father sent me there. He strongly approved of that. And that school was a very old-fashioned British school where you specialized at a very early age, about 13. You really started specializing heavily. And specialized means that you spent a good three-quarters of your time, at least, on one particular subject area. And also very old-fashioned, they took the brightest pupils, except occasionally for mathematicians. Otherwise, the brightest pupils were put under classics, which meant studying Latin and Greek. So I studied Latin and Greek while I was at that school, which was for nearly 5 years until I came to school leaving age at just under 18. And so I did Latin and Greek, which I learned in a very, very thorough, old-fashioned way. And there was one period in the week when you were allowed to study something with the approval of the teacher in charge, any subject that you liked, really. You could read some book which was nothing to do with classics. That was your kind of intellectual holiday, and I took advantage of it at first to pick up a book which had attracted my eye in a library or bookshop, I don't remember which was a book on Hinduism. And I thought it was great fun to read. I didn't take it very seriously in any way, but it was colorful and quite interesting. And so I got a little bit interested in Indian religion. The religious background of my household was that my parents were agnostics, they would have said, I think, rather than atheists, but in practice it's much the same thing. And the family background, going back a couple of generations, was Jewish, but they didn't practice Judaism at all, or indeed know or want to know anything about Judaism. I had learned a bit about Christianity, inevitably, by going to a Christian school, in fact, a series of Christian schools. And I thought it was all quite interesting, but I just couldn't understand how anybody could really believe this stuff, that is, believe the more serious parts of it. So it was quite a relief to me, in a way, I think, to discover that there were people in large parts of the world who believed totally different things, maybe equally implausible, but at least quite different. And gradually I developed a fascination which has never left me, as a kind of anthropological fascination for the variety of beliefs that people have. Many of them would strike me as totally preposterous. They're very much in evidence wherever you look, especially, so we say, today with the absolutely crazy political views that people have over most of the world, for which they actually seem to believe that there is some justification. And I remain basically very agnostic, or even an atheist as far as God goes. But I do think that that doesn't mean that these things are uninteresting to study. They're very interesting because they cause a lot of the trouble in the world and a few of the good things as well. And of course, they tend to underpin or at least connect to people's ethics. And ethics, I do think, are very important. And then I came across, when I was leaving school, I came across a book by E.A. Burt, The Sayings of the Compassionate Buddha. He was an American scientist, and I thought that the book was fascinating, and I discovered that the Buddha had what seemed to be very sensible and indeed profound ideas about ethics. So I was inclined to favor Buddhism in that very, very limited and ignorant way. I read some of his translations of Buddhist texts. And then when I left school, like every other boy of my age, or almost every other boy of my age in Britain at that time, I had 2 years of compulsory military service. And by pure chance, I was landed up in Hanover. Of course, there was no war at this time. This was in 1955. Late 1955, I ended up in Hanover, and my father had a friend there. My father was an art historian, and he was quite friendly, though he didn't know him very well, with the director of Hanover Art Gallery, who was a very pleasant, friendly man, and took me home to meet his family because he had a son and daughter who were just slightly younger than me. And the family were very nice to me, but I soon discovered that they were a little odd, being Germans in the middle of North Germany, because the wife, under the stress of the Nazi government she'd had to live through, had become rather eccentric, and part of the eccentricity was that she somehow became a Buddhist. I don't regard being a Buddhist as eccentric at all, but what was a bit eccentric was that she took so many of the cultural beliefs which tend to go with Buddhism, sort of belief in homeopathic medicine, astrology, you name it, all those kinds of beliefs. And I wasn't favorably impressed by that. But I was impressed by learning more about Buddhism. She had some meetings in her house at weekends, and there were so few Buddhists in North Germany that for these little meetings, people traveled long distances to be present, and I learned much more about Buddhism at that time. Well, I didn't think at the time that it was going to really influence my life or play a large part in my life, but in fact it did, because when I went up to Oxford University, where I'd won a scholarship before having to enter the army, I, of course, was expected to go on with my Latin and Greek, and that's what I did for a year and a half. But there comes a point, according to the Oxford curriculum in these subjects, where you can choose whether to go on and study more about the ancient world, in particular the history and philosophy of the Greeks and the Romans, or switch to something quite different. And by that time, I had had, well, about 7 years of Latin and Greek, and I was really rather bored with it. And so I decided I must do something else. And my first thought was to do China, because my father had, when he was an undergraduate, privately, not as part of his official curriculum, studied Chinese a bit and found it very, very interesting. And he remained to the end of his days not an expert on anything Chinese, but very fond of Chinese art and rather interested generally in Chinese culture, nothing to do with their politics. So I thought of doing Chinese, but Mao Zedong had come in and ran everything in China, and indeed foreigners were not allowed to come to China to study the Chinese, however pure their credentials. So I thought that would not be a very good idea, to have to study a subject, that is, a culture, a people, whom I was not even allowed to visit. So, somehow rather oddly, I moved over to India. Well, I say rather oddly, but that's not quite the case, because a boy who had been my best friend in school and had not had to do military service because he was gay, and gays, if you were known to be gay, you didn't have to do military service. So I was very envious of him, and he had decided to do Sanskrit and study ancient India instead of China. And he reported back that it was wonderful, beautiful, very interesting languages, beautiful also, beautiful poetry, beautiful drama, and so on. And he said, well, why don't you switch over to Sanskrit? And that's what I did. So I haven't quite reached Pali yet. I'm afraid it's a rather roundabout journey. But I did take up Sanskrit. And then when you did Sanskrit, the subject matter on which you were examined at the end of your course, which was a total of 4 years, but that includes the classics at the beginning, when you came to those exams, Sanskrit was your main language, and that was what you were mainly examined on, but you could choose from a number of subsidiary languages. And there was Buddhism waiting for me in Pali, the language of the early Buddhist scriptures. And it is fairly closely related to Sanskrit. It was therefore much the easiest option to take, and that's important. So I decided to do Pali, although, and I should say I've never regretted it. It really did become the main interest in my life, the main academic interest at least. But it wasn't a totally happy affair, because there was nobody else at the university, senior or junior, who had any interest in Pali. And so I virtually had to teach myself. And I decided at that point that that is not a very good way of learning a serious subject. And the things that I didn't know about Pali and early Buddhism would shock anybody now. But anyway, I managed to recover. When I took up the study of Pali at Oxford, I was the only person studying it, and there was nobody teaching it, and the university only recognized it through clenched teeth, so to speak. They just, if you want to do a special subject on that, you can do it, and so on. When I left after 28 years on the academic staff, we relapsed to exactly the same condition. I was appointed to teach Sanskrit and Pali, but that meant at least 80%, if not more, Sanskrit in terms of time and effort one had to give and so on. And my leaving would mean I would be replaced by somebody who might well not do Pali at all. And that is, in fact, indeed what happened. My successor, I was by that time professor of Sanskrit, but my successor in that chair was not remotely interested in Pali and wasn't going to teach it. And so I thought, by now I'd become very fond of Pali and very interested in it. I thought, this is really too bad. And I wasn't only interested. As I've sort of hinted in my opening preamble, I had two kinds of interests. One was a sort of anthropological interest in religion and how do people come to believe such extraordinary things and do extraordinary things in accordance with their beliefs. So I was pretty interested in anthropology, though I hadn't yet formally studied it at all. And in fact, I never came to study it really formally, though I did start reading some of the classic books on anthropology. So on the one hand, I had this kind of interest in the anthropology of religion, which I was happy to turn to studying Buddhism as well as any other religion. And on the other, I had this very thorough training in studying classical languages and examining their texts. And so I was sort of half ancient and half modern, so to speak. But oddly enough, the bread and butter lay on the ancient side, because there happened to be a job there. So I thought, let me try, and you can do almost anything at Oxford as long as you don't expect to get any money for it. And so I was allowed to start the Oxford Center for Buddhist Studies, which still exists today. This was when I took mandatory retirement in 2004, when I reached the age of 67. I had to retire, but I thought, well, I want to go on studying. In fact, this will be a good chance to have more time for research and so on. I was a bit naive about that, I must say. I didn't realize how much effort has to go into running even a very small academic institution. But I started the Oxford Center for Buddhist Studies, and I have been the academic director of that, which really means the director for more or less everything they do. And that means that I then could draw up what I wanted this institution to study. And what I wrote down was our aim was the study of Buddhism in all its traditions, in every form and according to any academic discipline. What the university insisted on, and I was perfectly in agreement with that, was that it always had to be studied in the academic sense. That is, it became registered with the government as an educational charity, not a religious charity. And if a monk, as indeed used to happen, a Buddhist monk from somewhere turned up in Oxford and said, I want to give a talk on Nirvana or something or whatever, I had to sort of politely cross-examine, was this really about faith or about scholarship? What were the criteria for accepting or rejecting a statement and so on? And when he said what seemed to me to reveal quite clearly, and why shouldn't it, that he wanted me to believe in whatever he said about Nirvana or whatever, I said, that's very interesting, and I shall come to your talk, but it cannot be given under the auspices of the Oxford Center for Buddhist Studies. There's a Buddhist society in the university run by the students, and that's where you should go, and that's where he therefore did go. I was also actually a founding member of Oxford University Student Buddhist Society, and even that was allowed to do more or less what it liked because it didn't represent the university's academic program. And so, in fact, of course, they had things like meditation classes and so on and all kinds of different lectures. And that's continued to this day. But it's very easy for anybody to see and understand when they look at our programs that the Oxford Center for Buddhist Studies has rather different aims. Aims which I'm afraid, of course, don't appeal to as many as would like to sit on a cushion and do some meditation. But it's therefore strictly an academic thing. And I should have realized and failed to realize that that would mean that most Buddhists would not want to give any donation to the Oxford Center for Buddhist Studies. Very few Buddhists have ever wished to give a donation, I may say, and nearly all the donations we have received have been really quite small. So it's been a great struggle in that respect. And my wife and I have more or less paid for the Oxford Center for Buddhist Studies most of the time. And I have never received any kind of salary from it, or indeed any recompense. If I earn money by giving a lecture or whatever, or indeed get royalties for what I write about Buddhism, almost all of that goes straight to the Oxford Center for Buddhist Studies. Otherwise, it would not exist.
And so, what role does this book play within the mission of the center?
Well, one of the trustees of the Oxford Center for Buddhist Studies, a very nice man called Tony Morris, he is a practicing Buddhist, and he is also a publisher. And he has published quite a variety of books. And one day he suddenly said he'd been walking in the Welsh mountains, which is where he comes from. And he said he'd had a great inspiration. He was going to study a series called Mud Pie Slices. I wasn't struck by the beauty or interest of that title. And then he said, and the first volume, Richard, will be by you. And you're a specialist in Pali, and the mud pie slices will be slices, that is, well, in only a metaphorical sense, but there will be Buddhism and something, and you're going to do Buddhism and Pali. And I like the man, and I wished him very well, and so on. And I could see that it was going to be very, very difficult for me to refuse him. This is a hopelessly honest account of how the book came to be written. I didn't leap at it.
So in the prologue, you actually talk about how you had some hesitation when you were writing the book. Can you explain why that was and what convinced you to write it in the end?
Well, the main hesitation was I thought that this whole idea was a bit crazy, because he's having future titles in his series will be things like Buddhism and football, Buddhism and the menopause, you name it. And I couldn't quite see myself fitting into that series, but he thinks he's very happy with it. And also, I thought it's going to be frightfully difficult. He wants the book to be published overtly and clearly stating that it's for the general public. Now, Pali is an ancient language, which very, very few people in the world have studied well. The very few people who have, 98% of them, live in Sri Lanka or Southeast Asia and don't know English and don't interact with the English-speaking world at all. So the number of people who know any Pali or have even sort of seen a Pali sentence is very small. And I wouldn't have thought that I could. I know something about languages, but I'm not a fully trained linguist. If I were even asked to write a book about Latin for the general public, I would think that was a frightfully difficult thing to do. How do you make it interesting? And so I thought, well, I can but set off and see what comes out of it. And I wrote this book, as I've written all my books, starting off on page one. I give all my students this advice, which I think may be very bad advice for many people, but it's the opposite of what they're usually told to do. I tell them not to make a plan of what they're going to say in chapter 1, chapter 2, chapter 3, chapter 4, and then reach the conclusion in, shall we say, chapter 7, and so on, and write out a wonderful schema for the whole thing before they start. I do exactly the opposite and recommend that people do exactly the opposite. I start on page one, and what comes on page two is the result, or the prerequisite for what's on page two is what I've written on page one. That's what happened to come out, and now I've got to find the connection, how to go on. So that's actually how I wrote this book. And I'm not sure that it's worked out entirely well, because it was only when I got to... I'm exaggerating a little bit, but when I got to chapter four, and I thought there would be four chapters, mainly because Toni Morris had told me that he wanted about sort of 12 to 15,000 words, so I had a word limit. And it was only when I got to chapter four that I suddenly started realizing that I was onto something very interesting. And that was, I had discovered, I think, that Pali was the language of the Buddha, and it followed partly from things that I'd written earlier. The book doesn't quite give the game away that this is why it happened, because when I gave it to Toni Morris, he was very complimentary about it. But it started with what is now Chapter 1, which is called Pali in History. And he said, look, the general public who read this book will want to know, just as you have asked, how did you get into Pali? Why are you interested in it? Something personal you've got to write. Mm-hmm. And I groaned and I said, but Pali is much more interesting than I am, which I sincerely believe. And he said, never mind, you've got to write something about how you got into it. And that's why there's a prologue called Discovering Pali. I wrote every word of it. But the credit for its being there must go entirely to Toni Morris, who forced me into it. So that's sort of separate, you see. And the real book is chapters 1 to 4. And chapter 4 is the really interesting stuff. Now, I think that's unfortunate, because it means if you're going to get to chapter 4, of course, you've got really to read chapters 1, 2, and 3, which are less interesting. But you need the knowledge you're given in chapters 1, 2, and 3 to understand what I'm talking about in chapter 4. It did pass through my mind to sort of scrap what I'd got, turn the whole book round, and start with the discoveries in chapter 4, but then I realized I didn't entertain that idea for many minutes, because I realized it couldn't be done, because chapter 4 depended on quite a lot of factual knowledge, which the reader has to be given first. And after all, it's a fairly slim book, so anybody who really is interested in the subject will probably manage to get through without giving up, given that it's only got 100 pages.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
The one thing I actually really did appreciate about the book was how you introduced information about the language, which is something that many learners of Pali, or even those who might have just basic familiarity with it, don't receive. I think that was very enlightening. So let's talk about the language itself. What are the origins of the Pali language, and what type of language is it?
The origins, in a sense, as I've written in several places in several different contexts, there are several different kinds of answers to this question. But if, a comparative philologist who looks at what are generally recognized as the main languages in the world today and says, how are they related, has a very simple answer. All the oldest evidence in India is from this language, Sanskrit, which is fascinating in many ways. And one of them is that we can be quite sure that Sanskrit existed for many centuries before writing came to India and things were written down in Sanskrit. It had a very long period as an oral language, and it's still going today, and it's a language on the internet and used for modern kinds of communications. And it's so it's really probably the most, resilient, the most surviving language which exists anywhere in the world. Mm-hmm. And it has a huge vocabulary and a very elaborate grammar, too. And it's impossible to do, I think, for Sanskrit, what I have done for Pali, because it's so complicated. Mm-hmm. Pali can very simply be said to be a highly simplified form of Sanskrit. But what really does one mean like that? Well, if you know any Italian and any and Latin, you can call Italian a simplified form of Latin. And in the case of Pali and Sanskrit, well, Pali comes from has much the same relationship to Sanskrit as Italian, or indeed French or Spanish, has to Latin. As the centuries go by, people simplify a lot. They use rather fewer phonetic distinctions. There are so fewer letters in the alphabet. It's simplified at the phonetic level. Much more important, it's very much simplified at the grammatical level. There are fewer different tenses and different ways of grammatical ways of teaching nouns and so on. And also, to some extent, it's simpler at the level of discourse, of syntax, of how sentences are made. They can be made rather like Sanskrit, very like Sanskrit sentences. But as the earliest literature that we have, which is the Pali canon, is largely about spoken Pali, it reproduces, or it says it reproduces, and I believe it, what the Buddha and his disciples and some of his opponents and people we had discussions with, what they were saying. Well, despite what I'm doing at this moment, on the whole, spoken language uses fairly short sentences and not such complicated constructions. So Pali is indeed, it has its own complications, and to teach Pali just by saying it's a simplified form of Sanskrit, which I may say is what is often done in Western universities, is not, I think, very satisfactory, because Pali goes off on its own here and there, and it's misleading to say to make that great simplification. But that's often the case, isn't it? It's helpful to somebody beginning a subject to be given massive simplifications so they get an idea of what kind of thing am I trying to learn here. But then you have to turn around and say, well, I fooled you. It's not really that simple.
And at what point did the language start to be written down? Because you said at first that this was mostly an oral tradition that these texts were carried on. And at what point did the ancient Buddhists start to put pen to palm leaf, so to speak?
Well, the languages we're talking about and the writing we're talking about is not terribly old in India by world standards. There was no writing at the time of the Buddha. And we know that for a couple of hundred years, there was no writing in India. And the oldest body of writing is inscriptions, almost all on stone, on rocks or stone pillars, by the Emperor Asoka in the middle of the 3rd century BC. That's around 250 BC and for the next 20 years or so. So Asoka left these world-famous inscriptions in which he talks largely about how he was converted to Buddhism and the things that he's learned from Buddhism which he wants to promulgate to all his people. Largely about ethics. So, and that's, as I say, it's the second half of the 3rd century BC. There's a lot of argument around the edges by scholars, because there are a few inscriptions which some people say could be older than Asoka, but I don't, that which are undated, you see. But I don't think it's very likely to be so. Of course, even dating Asoka was a problem at first, but luckily, there's one famous inscription, the 13th major rock edict, in which he refers to kings who ruled to the west of him, in Egypt, Syria, and so on. And we can identify most of those kings, not always with complete certainty, but never mind. And that gives us the synchronicity that enables us to match up Indian chronology with Western chronology, and it's the foundation for all our knowledge of ancient Indian chronology. So Asoka wrote these inscriptions, and he mentions some Pali texts. Well, he mentions texts from the canon. They're not in exactly the same dialect as Pali, but they're not that different. I mean, a bit like Swedish and Norwegian or something. It's not very difficult to get from one to the other. And so that's when there are bits of writing, but none of that is very extensive. And the Buddhist tradition has it that the canon as a whole was first written down in Sri Lanka about 30 years before the turn of the Christian era, before BC becomes AD. And some people don't believe it, and so on. Again, I do. And that's when it was all written down. You know, the role that writing has played varies so much from civilization to civilization. The real culture which is a writing culture is the Chinese. And the role that writing plays in China is completely different, unimaginable almost unless we have studied it, completely different in China from what it is, say, with us. Because those Chinese things are really true, really exist, or whatever, once they're written down, and not till then. They believe in writing totally. And that's not the way it is in India, and not in Buddhism on the whole. So that when I was doing my field work in Sri Lanka, I discovered that copies of the entire Buddhist canon, that is the Theravada Buddhist canon, the form of Buddhism they espouse, which are in Pali, which had usually been donated to them by pious followers and had usually come from the office I was in charge of then when I was president of the Pali Text Society. They were proudly displayed in the main reception room behind a glass-fronted bookcase. And I soon learned that it was not wise to ask if you could look at the books in the sense of take them out and go through the pages, because they started getting rather embarrassed, and they said, I'm afraid we've lost the key. And you practically you realize that they never opened these bookcases and never actually read the texts. But their training as monks had been oral, and they had learnt large sections of the text by heart. And it's difficult for us to believe, but of course there are cases in history of monks who've learnt the whole canon by heart. Mm. But the point that I'm trying to make, rather, is that if a Buddhist monk or pious lay follower wants to know what's in the canon, they don't usually look at a book. Nowadays, of course, it's so easy, you can look on the internet, and some people will do that. We're living in a different sort of age once that we have the computer and the internet. But what they always do is they refer to their memory or somebody else's memory of what the text says. And it still was, when I went there for my first field work in 1959, it still was actually more, no, sorry, I went in 64 first, but in 1964, it was still pretty much an oral culture as far as the religion went. Mm. Everything was done orally.
And now, in the written form of the Pali language, I think most people who have come across a couple of words or sentences in the past might be used to seeing it in the Latin script. But this obviously wasn't the case until rather recently. And which scripts or and which types of writing was the Pali language recorded up until now?
Yes, you're quite right. It's very important to understand that Pali is not a script. There is no such thing as Pali script. Scripts sort of operate quite independently of languages. The language that we speak is written in the basically in Italian script, the Roman or Latin script, and lots of other languages are too. But of course, there are other ways in which you can write it down. You can do it in a Cyrillic script or an Arabic script or whatever. And so Pali has always been written, can I say simply, in the local script. So in Cambodia, it will be in a Cambodian script, in Thailand in Thai, in Sri Lanka in Sinhala script, in Burma in Burmese script, and in the West, we put it into Latin script. And we tend to win out. I'm speaking, as I say, as the former head of the Pali Text Society, which subsists by printing and distributing books of Pali in the Latin script, as well as their translations. We win out because such a large part of the world nowadays uses the Latin script. The script is, it's not really important.
Okay.
Of course, with the script, there go various conventions, such as the use of punctuation. And Indian manuscripts are a little difficult for us at first to get used to, because not only do they not mark the beginnings and ends of sentences, although they started taking that up, shall we say, in the 18th and 19th centuries mainly, they don't even make spaces between words. So that makes it a little more difficult to read.
Now, turning back to the language itself, Pali, of course, obviously has very large differences between English and other Western European languages. Could you describe some of the linguistic features that an English speaker would find familiar and which they would find foreign?
Well, firstly, let's take the different levels of a language. I mean, the phonetic level. In Pali, you have some of the commonest sounds or consonants have aspirated and non-aspirated forms. So, for instance, if you say "d," that's a T, and you say, and it's an unaspirated T. If you say "t," that's an aspirated T. Now, if we take, or the same would go for P, for instance, "p" or "p." And those are different letters in Pali. In English, we actually tend to say we have a P at the beginning of a word before a vowel. We say something like pit or pot, and that's kind of halfway between the aspirate and the non-aspirate. We don't make the difference. So there you've got a case where you have two letters which an English person wouldn't immediately pick up that they were different if they just if you just heard the language spoken, but they are two entirely different letters. Similarly, with vowels, you have a short vowel and a long vowel. U and U are two different letters, and these differences are always marked in whatever script you use. Since in our script, we don't actually have a difference between a short U and a long U. What we do is we put a mark over a long U, a bar, technically called a macron. So if you write just the letter U, that's a short U. If you're writing Pali, as in Buddha, if you use want a long U, you have to put a bar over it. So we have these diacritics. Some English people make a lot of fuss about that, but of course, German and French, there they tend to call them accents, though they aren't all called accents. In the case of U in German, you have U with two dots on, that's called an umlaut, and you have the difference between U and Ü. So these kind of things are common across practically all languages. Mm-hmm. Apart from that, and as for the aspiration, well, we can write TH too, but of course in English that makes the sound F. And that sound doesn't exist in Pali, so there's no danger of confusion. As for the, it's an inflecting language. The grammar is the big stumbling block for beginners until you get used to it. So we have it only in the pronouns, really. So if I can say, I see you and you see me. And I is the subject, used when it's a subject, and me is the object. But of course, that's just one example from a vast range of possibilities, which doesn't apply just to pronouns, but to all nouns and adjectives and so on. And so on. There are variations of the endings of words with verbs, whether it's the first person, I, the second person, you, or the third person, he, she, or it. And there's a variation between the singular and the plural. And then, well, the structures to make longer sentences, to run words together, are also rather different, although in Pali they're pretty simple compared to English, I would say. It's sufficiently simple in Pali for it to be possible, as I do in Chapter 2, to give an adequate description in about 10 pages. So that shows you it's pretty simple.
All right. Now, in the next chapter on the style of Pali prose, you actually say, quote, "The Pali Canon is one of the world's greatest documents of oral literature, and the greatest single factor in determining its style must have been that orality." And yes. What ways can we see the oral transmission reflected in the style of Pali prose?
The repetition, above all. The fact that I'll go to the corner shop to get some bread. I'll go to the corner shop to get some bread, butter, milk, cheese, and eggs. That's how we put it. The Pali canon will tend to say, I'll go to the corner shop to get some bread, I'll go to get some butter, I'll go to get some cheese, I'll go to get some eggs. Like that. There's a great deal of redundant repetition. Now, why do you have that? I think the answer is pretty obvious. You're trying to memorize these texts. So if you just have a list of objects, there's nothing really to hang it on to, is there? And if you forget one, you tend to, it goes. There's no obvious way of saying, oh dear, I've forgotten one. Well, one way to make sure that you've got it is to do this repetition. Another way is to give numbered lists. And Buddhism, early Buddhism, is full of numbered lists. So it's as if we were to say, to give a rather silly example, but not very far from what actually happens in Pali, there are five emotions, there are four feelings, or what, etc. What matters is that you know five, four, six of this, and two of that. And so you know when you've forgotten something, or you've got, I've got too long a list, something must be there which I've put in and shouldn't be there. So they use these numbers too. Another way of ensuring, or you can never ensure, but getting close to ensuring that you remember the thing correctly, is verse, where you've got a meter, or, you know, rules about long and short syllables, which is mainly what you get in Pali. Again, you can say, there should be five long syllables in this line. The version that I've remembered only has four long syllables. I must have forgotten something there, which has another long syllable. I've put in a shorter word for a longer one or something like that. So those are features which help memorization. And as I mentioned somewhere in the book, we're discovering through actual experiments, live experiments in India even today, not among Pali scholars, alas, because they don't have many in India now, but Sanskrit scholars have the most astounding way of memorizing, not just the way of memorizing, but they can remember enormous quantities. And this has now been, you know, we have all the recording facilities, et cetera, et cetera. And then we can easily show nowadays neurological differences in the brain when you have got a huge capacity to memorize. And it's not just quantity. One of the things I find most interesting and most important for the subject I'm studying is that they can do this as some musicians can do it with music. They hear a thing once, a sentence, and can repeat it perfectly. And there are people who have this capacity almost complete. And what that gives us an answer to when the Buddha spoke and preached, and there was no writing and, of course, no recording apparatus of any kind, and people said, oh, the Buddha on such and such an occasion sat down under a banyan tree and spoke and said, monks, I'm going to teach you about such and such. How did anybody know? Is this just a sort of fanciful reconstruction? If anybody asked the question before, they were thought to be rather nutty, that you couldn't possibly answer such a question. But now I think we can see that there is a fairly straightforward answer. Yes, there were people present who had trained their memories so that they could, probably for only a fairly short period after he'd done it, possibly not, possibly for a longer period, they could say exactly what the Buddha had said. And of course, they valued what he said so much that when there was one monk or nun or other person there who said, he said, ba, 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 then the other people would say, let me say it again, I want to remember it too. And they passed it on in this way orally, in a way that I'm afraid we would be incapable of doing.
And so you believe that this is part of the evidence that makes the argument plausible that the Pali Canon records the words of the Buddha as conveyed by Ananda at the first Buddhist council. Is that correct?
Oh, well, Ananda is only credited with a part, though a very large part, of the Buddhist canon. Upali is credited with the first part, the monastic regulations and so on. But yes, when the Buddha died, the monks assembled. The texts tend to say there were 500, but that's a conventional number which occurs all over the place and just means a very large number. Sorry, we couldn't count. We couldn't count it. But the monks assembled and they decided in a systematic way. They had somebody in the chair, so to speak, who said, now tell us what he said next and where did he say this and when did he say this and so on. And somebody got up and recited it. And then other people, it must have already taken place sort of all over the place that monks, after all, monks were supposed not to live alone. Occasionally they did, but the Sangha means a community and they're a community, the monks and similarly the nuns, and they must have done this sort of thing which was imitated in the first council many, many times during the Buddha's long lifetime. There is one story which is helpful of a young monk turning up at the place where the Buddha's staying, and he says, oh, I've studied your work. The Buddha said, really? Recite something to me. And he recites, it tells us the text that he recites. And it's a set of religious poems. And the Buddha says, very good, you got it all right. Well, I think that is probably a true story.
You go on to further argue that the Buddha is responsible for the language itself, Can you explain what you mean by that?
The most interesting part of the book, that's in chapter 4. And I think that that is really, really, really interesting. The funny thing is that I think this is the one great discovery I've made. You go to any Buddhist now in Sri Lanka and so on, and you say, hey, you know, this is actually what exactly what the Buddha said. The words, it's not just that they mean the same or something, they're in exactly the same form. And he just looks at you pityingly and says, but I always knew that. Because for them, it's an act of faith. Mm-hmm. And they do believe. The Pali Canon is known as Buddha Vachana, the words of the Buddha. And they do take that very literally. And, of course, no Westerner or Western scholar has taken it literally. They think it's a very, very simplified sort of myth that the Buddhists tell. But then, of course, the scholars all argue fantastically with great vehemence against each other and say, but what dialect did he actually speak? And my answer is a mixed dialect. And you see, I didn't answer your question about what dialect was Pali, because my answer is that it isn't any one dialect. There are features in Pali which connect it with quite far east in what would be modern-day Bihar, perhaps even the edges of Bengal, and other parts which connect it, I mean, other features, not parts, but features of the language, of the phonetics, which connect it much further, sort of halfway to Delhi, much further north and west. It's a sort of on a northwest to southeast axis. And we know that the Buddha spent his life, or the after enlightenment, that's about 45 years, walking up and down in this area and preaching. But we also know, because it's the same to this day, that actually the language changes slightly from every village to village to village. The people who never move, the farmers who are there all their lives and maybe have never traveled more than 5 miles away from their own home, have their own dialect, which is quite like the one next door, or at least I should say it's a little like the one to the north, it's a little like the one to the south, but not in the same respect, and so on. They're all speaking dialects which are closely related, but they're not exactly the same. And the Buddha has to communicate with these people. He has to understand what they say to him, and he has to say something to them which they will understand. And it suddenly struck me, and it's funny that it hasn't struck a great many people, that Pali is very odd, because very common words like you and me and so on have so many different forms in Pali. And I think around to the languages we all know, English, French, German, etc., we don't need a lot of different words for I and you, do we? Or different forms. But I think this is because, you know, it's an amalgam, and he's speaking exactly as the locals are speaking, and it's not quite the same as they speak 10 miles down the road. Though obviously, it's pretty similar. Is that clear?
I believe it's so, yes. And then you said that this, as you said, was a bit of a lingua franca that the Buddha used when he was preaching, or was this a language that he spoke in when he was not preaching as well, in his everyday life?
I think that's what he spoke all the time, because you see also he acquired disciples here, there, and everywhere, and they would have had slightly different dialects. But these people then passed their entire lives together, day in, day out, went through various experiences together and so on. And I think then the thing sort of gels, and an important part of my theory or discovery is about the argot, that they are a kind of closed community, the Sangha. They're always very keen to have new recruits, and obviously they lose some people along the way, but they're a fixed body of men and women who move around and have the same things to talk about, what the Buddha says they should do, what the Buddha says they would be well advised to think, and so on, how the Buddha says they should behave. And they say, they use this mixed dialect, and it becomes characteristic of them. It can't be, again, same argument repeated, it can't be totally different from what local people speak, and then otherwise nobody's going to understand, but it's distinctive. Mm. It's as their tradition. And you see, we know that these texts survived in several different forms in different parts of ancient India. Most of this evidence is lost, but not all of it. And we know that this was so. And for instance, the most important thing we know in this respect is that the Pali canon was somehow transmitted to Sri Lanka, which is quite a long way away. Obviously, the local language in Sri Lanka, although it had the same origin ultimately from Sanskrit, but it obviously wasn't very close to what was spoken up in Bihar in northern India, where the Buddha, sort of the center of where the Buddha spent his life. But if a group of monks went down, I think they could easily connect through this Argul with the local language. And that's what became then preserved in Sri Lanka, despite the fact that for them, they were learning something rather different, but still not so different as to make it impossible. We can think of lots of analogies if we look at modern European languages, some of which are very close to each other and some a bit further, but still mutually intelligible, like, so we say, Czech and Polish, pretty different, but still with a little effort and goodwill, they can understand each other, and so on. So these degrees of difference vary a lot, and that's very important for understanding the actual linguistic situation, not just in ancient India, but as a colleague of mine, Imre Banga, who's an expert on North Indian languages of more recent times, as he says, it's much the same today.
And then one of the aspects of the book that I found absolutely fascinating was how you explained the relationship between the Pali language and Buddhism, and how the Pali language embodies the essence of the Buddha's teaching and Buddhism itself. Could you talk about that a little bit, please?
Well, we have evidence in the canon of the Buddha saying, he says it in several different ways, in several different places, and he says, don't cling to my words. Firstly, he says, you've got a word for pot in this village, which is so-and-so, and then the pot, such a pot in the next village, as I happen to know, is called something different, but it's the same pot. And it doesn't really matter at all which word you use, as long as you understand you're talking about pots. But the same is true at a much more important level. And things can be put in different ways. And to understand what I say is not at all the same thing as understanding the exact words that I use. And it's really silly to get into arguments about which are the right words, because ultimately, and this is quite subtle, and the real argument is several pages long, and I can't give it all now, but ultimately, language isn't reality anyway. Language is our way of representing reality to ourselves and other people. So the language, not just in terms of phonetics and so on, but even conceptually, it doesn't ever exactly capture reality. It's a pointer towards things. It excludes a lot of things, but which are quite different, but it doesn't exclude some things which are very similar. So he's got this philosophy of language that it doesn't actually capture reality. And that's very important in ancient India, and that comes out of ancient Indian thought, because the Brahmins who spoke Sanskrit claimed that there was an inherent eternal bond between saying the word cow and the animal, the cow. And the animal, the correct word for the animal was cow, and if you said vache in French or something, well, that was very inferior, and you were much further away from reality. And the Buddha was completely in disagreement with that and argued against it. So language is not reality, but it's a communication system. And it can't be perfect, but it's a lot better than nothing.
As a person who is very enthusiastic about spreading the teaching of Pali, I'd like to ask you, do you think the future of learning Pali is a bright one?
I'm afraid I don't. I think that on the whole, largely because of the internet and the use of English being so useful for everybody, the study of languages other than English is in catastrophic decline. I mean, if I look at the school system in this country, it was not very bright when I was a child. The amount of foreign language that you learnt and the standard, which was appalling on the whole, of how you learnt it was very, very depressing. And it's just got worse and worse. And fewer school children actually study a foreign language. And with foreign languages, of course, I include the ancient languages for us, Latin and Greek are the crucial ones. So language study is really on a very long, steep slide. As for Pali, I've mentioned that there are people in Southeast Asia and so on who actually do still study Pali to a high standard in a traditional way, but those people hardly ever know English, and there's no communication with them, really. They're not interested in what we think. I gave a nice example when I said that if I told them, I've discovered that the words written down in the Pali canon are exactly what the Buddha said, they would look pityingly at me and say, we've always known that. They don't have any feeling for the kind of evidence that we want to prove something. So I don't have much hope, really, of combining with them. And also, of course, terrible, terrible things are being done by Theravada Buddhist monks and so on, especially in Burma to the Rohingyas, but not so good. It's not so good in Sri Lanka in what they've been doing to the Tamils, though they had a lot of excuse, unlike the Burmese, and not so good in Thailand and so on. So the heartland of Theravada Buddhism, where the language Pali is the sacred and liturgical language, is quite small in world terms, and it's not acquitting itself very well. So I think that modern people who incline towards Buddhism and want to learn about Buddhism are much more likely either to go to the Tibetans, who have a great romantic glamour to them, or to the Japanese, Chinese, and Koreans, none of whom know Pali, and indeed, most of whom are just as ignorant about Pali as are other people in our own country. So I'm not very optimistic, but let's do what we can with my little book.
And Richard, what's next for you?
What next? My goodness. Well, I'm working and have been for some time with a friend and colleague who is a sociologist of Buddhism. I'm giving vent to my other intellectual interest, and we're doing research on and writing books, articles, and I hope a book on contemporary Taiwanese Buddhism and how it relates to Chinese. It is, of course, a form of Chinese Buddhism, but how it relates to the older forms of Chinese Buddhism and that sort of thing. So I'm still very interested in the sociology of religion, but I'm 81. And I don't work as many hours a day as I used to, and I don't get around to libraries as easily as I used to. So the answer to what's next for you might be the same as for everybody.
Well, I found this book absolutely fascinating. I think it was a very interesting introduction to the language itself that we often don't get to see as learners of the language. And I just want to thank you again for appearing on the show today and telling us a little bit about your book, Buddhism and Pali. It was an absolute pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you very much. The pleasure was mine. Thank you.
Take care.
You've been listening to New Books in Buddhist Studies with Alex Carroll. If you're interested in learning about other new books in Buddhist Studies, head over to newbooksnetwork.com or search for New Books Network wherever you get your podcasts. Audio used with permission by Délicieuse Musique and is taken from the song Small Flowered by Para Forcuva.